From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, we're digging into predictions that Georgia is turning blue. Like much of the Deep South, the state fell reliably in the Democrat column for most of the 20th century. But Republicans have held the state house and legislature since 2003 and 2005, respectively. One prevailing theory for that shift? The Southern strategy. Targeted messages and tactics used by the GOP to realign the loyalty of white Southern Dixiecrats beginning in the Civil Rights era. Well, we're getting one view on the Southern strategy from Stefan Forbes, who made a prize-winning film about Lee Atwater, who mastered the Southern strategy throughout the campaigns of Presidents Reagan, Bush 1, and Bush 2. Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story, follows the man whose tactics have stamped American politics ever since. Stefan Forbes, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the Southern strategy, if you could summarize it for us?
In the Southern strategy, you never talked about race explicitly. That was the whole key. It was plausible deniability. So you came up with code words like busing or fair housing legislation, things that actually were wedge issues for white people in the North, because it was easy for most white people to get behind ending Jim Crow. But things that touched suburban New York or Chicago, you know, you could win over these Reagan Democrats to the Republican Party. And if you look at the effect of that, the school system in New York is still separate and unequal, you know, 100 years after slavery. So this stuff worked. It forestalled real political change. And the best thing about it was you could always say it never worked. It never existed. And people still do that today, even though you had heads of the RNC like Ken Melman and Michael Steele apologize for the Southern strategy. People still deny that it was ever used.
Yes. Barry Goldwater's biographer wrote, "It is a way to win the vote of racists without sounding like racists." And into this backdrop, after decades of that, comes Lee Atwater, Atlanta-born, raised in South Carolina, a young Republican. Help paint a picture of this character.
You know, Lee's favorite thing was being misunderestimated by his opponents. They saw him as a dumb country boy, you know, barefoot, guitar-picking Southerner who, you know, he went to Newberry College, just barely a college. He didn't grow up in Harvard Yard. Everything that they saw as his shortcoming and his weakness, Lee Atwater turned into a strength. And before he was done, he completely revolutionized American politics and had a huge hand in the Southernification of the GOP.
In the film, the people that you speak to portray him more as an opportunist than an ideologue. What did you discover about his motivation?
Well, yeah, I mean, the best political operatives have, shall we say, a moral flexibility that allows them to do whatever it's going to take to win. You know, he was completely Machiavellian. Some people thought he could have become a Democrat just as easily, but he saw this huge youth gap in the Republican Party. And he realized this was the place to get ahead. This is the way to make a career. And when he did, it was really a decision that changed America. And I'm sure we'll get into the amazing transformation that he wreaked on our country. It's incredible what this one guy did. And it's ironic, too, that a lot of Democrats still don't really know who he was, and they don't know how to fight the campaign tactics that he pioneered in presidential elections.
The 1988 campaign of George H.W. Bush was where Atwater really made his mark. What made him so effective?
Well, you know, it's still one of the greatest come-from-behind victories in American political history. George Herbert Walker Bush, this elitist, kind of wussy, wimpy guy perceived as a totally ineffectual leader, was down 17 points after the Democratic convention. People had written him off. They were talking about President Dukakis. And Lee pulled off a feat of political jujitsu that is stunning. And the way he did it was by bringing Southern stump politics, which were really the province of local, state, and congressional races, into presidential politics for really the first time in 100 years. He knew that he had to make things ugly. He had to use wedge politics, the politics of fear. He had to impugn Dukakis's manhood the way people would do on a stump down south. And he knew that these people from Harvard Yard, like Susan Estrich, would have no idea how to combat this stuff. It didn't work so well with Clinton and James Carville 4 years later, who had studied this stuff happening. But in 1988, it was a knockout punch.
He did play up his own regions, the southern regions' mistrust of these eastern elites, painting Dukakis, who was the son of Greek immigrants, as a, what did he say, eating Belgian endive and eating quiche out of a can. Did it hit its mark?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, it's one of the great feats of political rhetoric that the party that was always helping the working class got rebranded as these Volvo-driving, Chardonnay-sipping liberal elites. You know, it's something that's still working today. It's yielding incredible fruit in politics, and the Democrats still don't really know how to come back against that stuff. But it was the politics of resentment that Lee understood incredibly well. And ironically, if the Democrats had learned from Atwater, hadn't just written him off and looked down on him morally, which is understandable, they'd know how to fight against a guy like Donald Trump. Donald Trump calling Jeff Sessions a dumb Southerner. Here's a guy with a law degree. He's the highest ranking law enforcement official in the land. You're going to impugn him like that and, you know, calling him mentally retarded. That strikes such a deep chord across the South. That's not, Lee Atwater could have gone to town with that. And this is, these are essential parts of American political discourse that the Democrats still don't understand how deep those veins of resentment run.
We're getting a masterclass on a master of the Southern strategy with Stefan Forbes, who produced and directed the 2008 documentary Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story. So Atwater helped to plant rumors about Elizabeth Dole during the primaries, trying to cut away at the leads or popularity of Bob Dole. But as you point out, particularly pointed in the post-convention general election against Dukakis. Now, you said Dukakis up 17 points during the Atlanta convention, but that number decreased following this disturbing ad.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
Willie Horton, the prisoner mentioned there, became infamous, an African-American man. So clearly playing race in this game, was that the deciding factor in the 1988 Bush-Dukakis election?
You know, I don't think you can ever point to one deciding factor. They accused his wife, Kitty Dukakis, of burning a flag. President Reagan accused Michael Dukakis of insanity. I mean, it was all part and parcel of the politics of personal destruction. They went to Texas and told everyone that Dukakis was going to take everyone's gun away. But there were interesting things going on underneath the surface. In that campaign, Lee Atwater was the first to also recognize the incredible political potential of the candidate's son, George W. Bush, who had a drinking problem and who had never really amounted to much. And it's amazing in the film, we kind of get to look at this footage of W. growing up under Lee's expert tutelage and becoming this bare-knuckled political brawler. It's an amazing transformation. And for Atwater to do that, he was incredibly guilty about having done that. He was a guy who idolized black musicians, who kind of saw himself as a figure that could bridge these two worlds. He palled around with James Brown and B.B. King. And I know that personally, for him as a Southerner to do this, it was painful, but he knew that this was the way to win.
Lee Atwater, reflecting his deep appreciation of African-American music and abiding friendships with musicians Isaac Hayes, B.B. King, and Chuck Jackson, who he performed with. So against that, we have the seemingly conflicting message of Atwater from a tape here speaking in 1981. Now, this tape was handed over to James Carter IV, and we do warn you the sentiment is pretty offensive.
You start out in 1954 by saying, by 1968, you can't say that. Hurts your backfire, so you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites.
So there's Atwater in 1981. N-word is what he's saying there. Stephon Forbes, how do you reconcile these two sides of this man?
You know, as a Southerner, he knew what would work in national presidential elections. You know, we inherit this toxic legacy as Americans. The politics of fear have been practiced on us for centuries. And, you know, our internal guilt at the violence that we've done to black people is transmogrified into this projection of all these evil values onto them as predators, as, you know, criminals. And so, you know, racism hurts white Americans in this really devious way. Atwater understood the subtleties of that. He knew how to play upon those fears without really doing it overtly. And, you know, it's unfortunately, it took a Southerner who really understood these views to bring them back into the mainstream of American politics to the point where once it started working so well, it became almost inevitable that these kind of tactics would be used and that we would get a Donald Trump calling white nationalists very fine people and using the playbook of the boogeyman to just totally concentrate political power in the era that we're living in now. It's quite disturbing.
Well, Lee Atwater was diagnosed with a brain tumor. He apologized for his depiction of Willie Horton and things that he said about Michael Dukakis. Now, this was shortly before he died. Do the people you interviewed for the film think that Lee Atwater was sincere in those apologies?
You know, like everything else about the guy, that is a totally divisive topic. You know, he was terrified that he was going to hell for the things he had done. Were they explicitly racial? Was it the politics of personal destruction? People like Mary Madeline believe that, you know, ironically, Lee, who had demonized so many other people, has been demonized since his death, that his political acumen, his insight into the power of class as well as race, and his, you know, incredible political jujitsu, his joyful kind of assuming of the mantle of bad boy, you know, was a way of signaling to the press with a wink and a nod that, you know, these things are okay. It's the way politics is done. He did a lot to legitimize these really nasty tactics in the Washington political establishment. And, you know, a lot of his defenders feel that, ironically, he's been demonized for that since his death. And letting other people off the hook, you know, you got to wonder when Trump is gone, how fast, you know, Republicans will be dropping him like a hot potato and saying, ah, you know, he happened to win. We didn't like any of that stuff. The fact is it delivered them electoral victories and it's given them seats on the Supreme Court and wholesale rewriting of the tax code. There are fruits of these tactics of racism and divisiveness. And we have to be really clear that when you engage in this kind of politics, you're going to be called out on it.
Well, Barbara Bush famously disliked Lee Atwater. She thought he was crude. He definitely broke political norms. Is that part of the Lee Atwater legacy? And what has that meant for politics since?
Lee Atwater was a godsend for George Herbert Walker Bush, one of the waspiest of GOP candidates. He was a throwback to the Rockefeller Republicans. He really couldn't win in 1988. Lee, who loved professional wrestling, he read the National Enquirer. He had a Fellini-esque sense of the American electorate. He was able to coat this patrician wasp with the patina of cowboy boots and Texas cowboy hats. And, you know, he was able to paint George Bush as a flag-waving redneck, which was an incredible achievement. And Lee welcomed in a whole new class of people into the GOP. He used a W as his point man to outreach to Southern evangelicals who had been really resistant to enter politics, to bring politics into the pulpit. Lee created a political juggernaut down South by giving his party's really questionable economic and racial tactics the moral a sort of moral blessing from the pulpit. I think you can see Lee Atwater's massive effect in American politics, most simply in the character of our president today. In 2016, the thought of President Donald Trump was a joke to most Americans. Back in 1988, Lee actually suggested him as VP to George Herbert Walker Bush, who wrote about it in his diary, said it was strange and unbelievable. Lee saw, even back then, where American politics was heading and where he was planning to drag it, that the key things would be a resentment against elites, this everyman outsider attitude, blunt talk, racial animus, a killer instinct, and a tabloid sensibility. You could see it all in Donald Trump.
The Kingmaker, as one of your guests called him.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Stephon Forbes is producer and director of Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story. And that 2008 film is now having a remarkable resurgence. You can watch a trailer at gpbnews.org. And we want to know what you think. Are you hearing or seeing campaign tactics and messages designed to scare white voters? Leave us a message at 404-500-9457, or you can reach us on Twitter or in our Facebook group. Now, with that historic perspective behind us, we're going to look at some real numbers and trends as we give predictions that Georgia's turning blue a second thought. That's just ahead on GPB.